Hello everyone, this is Dark Journalist with a very special episode for you with the man who created the remote viewing program at Stanford Research Institute, or SRI. Physicist Russell Targ will be joining us. Now, his background in laser research combined with his deep interest in the mysteries of the mind have led him to witness some of the most remarkable experiences of psychic phenomena in the Stargate program, working with the CIA and the military. Today, Russell will go deep with his insights on the nature of consciousness and how we really do possess a limitless mind, far beyond anything we could have imagined. Here we go. Physicist Russell Targ, SRI, Stargate, and remote viewing revealed.
Russ, it's great to have you here.
I'm happy to be with you. I'm always happy to talk about the remarkable work we did at SRI during the Cold War.
Yes. You recorded so much of that in your book on ESP, which I have here, which is The Reality of ESP. How much is psychic phenomena at the root of remote viewing?
Well, remote viewing is a kind of psychic phenomena. You can do lots of things with your non-local awareness. You can forecast what's going to happen in the future, as we did forecasting silver futures. You can find a lost bracelet. You can describe a weapons factory in Soviet Siberia. You can look at atomic dimensions, as the Theosophical Society was interested in doing at the end of the 19th century, and gave the first accurate description of what a proton would look like. The Theosophical researchers, Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater, described protons and the triangular form of quarks and gluons 100 years before they were described as quarks and gluons. And I have that. I published that in The Reality of ESP, photographed it right out of the 1895 book, 1895 magazine called Lucifer.
That's absolutely fascinating. And of course, the Theosophical Society, part of that mystery school movement, deep researchers on psychic phenomena. Now, you grew up with a deep interest in theosophy.
I was involved in the Theosophical Society. I was sort of a child theosophist. I was in graduate school in 1954. And I was also involved in the Theosophical Society in New York because they were very friendly and receptive towards psychic stuff because they had great psychics working with them in the 19th century doing perception that turned out 100 years later to be totally verified.
So we would call them kind of a spiritualist organization that had a kind of a core philosophy that was more Eastern.
That's right. It was formed by Helena Blavatsky, who was a psychic Russian, very thoughtful woman. She gets the bad rap because she did a lot of other things, but no one doubts that she was very psychic and was the creator of the Theosophical Society, which is still a worldwide organization.
How would you describe them?
The Theosophical Society, like many spiritual organizations, feel mainly that there is no separation in consciousness. Separation is an illusion. We are all one in consciousness. And she shares that with the Buddhists and the Taoists and most other people who have quieted their mind and become aware that there is no separation in consciousness.
Right. So she put out a series of books. One of them was Isis Unveiled in the 1870s, and people had never really seen this kind of material before.
That's right. She was a pioneer.
And so by the time they get to 1895 with the leaders,
Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater, who took over upon Blavatsky's death.
Yeah, Charles Leadbeater and Annie Besant were the two great psychics of that period.
And when you look back at that discovery that they made, they're using non-scientific methods. They're using consciousness methods to observe these atomic structures.
Oh, of course. Blavatsky had the idea that the periodic table was just discovered. Give you an idea who Blavatsky was. She was aware of the periodic table. She knew about science going on in England. And she said, we should make a psychic periodic table. So she got Leadbeater and Besant to look at a block of paraffin. And paraffin is 99% hydrogen protons. So she said, why don't you look at this block of paraffin? And that will tell you, we can start with hydrogen because that's the beginning of the periodic table, and draw me a picture of a hydrogen atom. And they drew this triangular shape with little balls at the corner, and the balls at the corner of the triangle they called fundamental atomic units, and they were connected by bands of energy. And today, physicists still draw those triangular units making up the proton, and the little balls of energy are called they're connected by gluons, and what are they called? The quarks.
Quark. Yes.
A proton is made of three quarks on a apex of a triangle, connected by gluons, and the contemporary drawing of a proton with quarks and gluons is exactly the same as Leadbeater drew 100 years ago. So it shows that consciousness penetrates everything. There's no blocking to consciousness.
Would you say then that Leadbeater was practicing a kind of remote viewing in order to get this information?
You could say remote viewing is an ability to quiet your mind and describe and experience what's going on in the distance or in the future. This kind of, a woman recently got a PhD for doing microscopic remote viewing of bacteria. So you can look at very small things, or once Ingo Swann, the great psychic, Ingo was the father of remote viewing in this era. Mm-hmm. And I had a contract from NASA to build an ESP teaching machine. Incidentally, you can have that ESP teaching machine free from the internet. I'm about to show you what it looks like. So here's the ESP game called ESP Trainer. This was a year-long, $100,000 program at NASA where I showed that we could teach astronauts or anybody else how to quiet their mind and describe what you're going to see in a little while.
Great. Yeah, so let's go into that ESPResearch.com. That's where the app is.
I was sitting in my office with my contract monitor from NASA, and Ingo was there, and George Pesdart, who was the contract monitor for the teaching machine program. And he said, Ingo, we're about to send a spacecraft to Jupiter, the Pioneer 2 spacecraft. They'll be there in a few months. Can you tell us if we'll find anything interesting that we didn't know about, Ingo? And Ingo said, yes, let me take a puff on my cigar here. Give me something to write on. And he said, I see Jupiter, and there's a ring of ice crystals around there, single broad ring of ice crystals. And George said, well, aren't you thinking of Saturn? Saturn is the one that has the ring. And Ingo said, I've been looking at the solar system my entire life. I know the difference between Jupiter and Saturn. When you get to Jupiter, a mere 500 million miles away, you will see that it has a ring of ice crystals, even though nobody has seen it before this. Amazing. And 8 months later, NASA sent us pictures of Jupiter with a ring of ice crystals around it. So Ingo was able to flip his awareness, notice that he is one with Jupiter, And it took him no time at all to create this unique drawing. And I show that in my book. I show Ingo's detailed drawing together with the NASA photograph of Jupiter. So the important thing when I talk about the idea that consciousness penetrates everything, that is, our mind is limitless. I have another book called Limitless Mind, that you can see the very small, you can see the very large. There are no limits to your consciousness. And the Buddhists say that your nature is timeless awareness. This was all understood 2,500 years ago.
I see. Would you say in your experiments then, what you were doing was directing that consciousness to a certain time and place?
That's right. When we were working for the CIA, they would say, one of the things we did with Ingo, CIA came to us and said, something's going to happen at these geographical coordinates, latitude and longitude, 3 days from now. So here we are on Wednesday. We want to know what's going to happen at this location 3 days from now. And Ingo said, well, that's very beautiful. It looks like a pyrotechnic display in the sky. It looks like the 4th of July, and there's a row of trucks at the back of that display. Give me some colored pencils and I'll draw that. And at that moment, that was enough information for the CIA to know that the Chinese atomic bomb test they were following would in fact take place, and it would fail. Because what Ingo described was what you get when you burn uranium in the air. Uranium is a pyrophoric material, like tungsten, or anyway, it burns very freely. So when you burn uranium in the air, like magnesium, it gives you a bright collection of streamers in the air, but no mushroom cloud. It was very important. Ingo was able to focus his attention 10,000 miles to the west, 3 days in the future, and see this pyrotechnic display in the sky over those coordinates. And that information was unique. The CIA had an idea that the Chinese were going to test an atomic bomb. Ingo and we didn't know anything about that, of course. So Ingo was able to describe what the CIA could recognize as a failed atomic bomb test at those coordinates. And a week later, we learned that, in fact, what he described is exactly what took place.
Incredible.
So Ingo was able to, so when you ask me what could Ingo see, basically Ingo could see anything. As he could describe a Chinese atomic bomb test 3 days in the future, 10,000 miles to the west, and he could describe what's going on in Jupiter, 500 million miles away in present time.
It's truly amazing. And how do we explain it?
See, it's interesting. At the early, in the year 800, Padmasambhava brought Buddhism to Tibet. And he said that you can quiet your mind. The idea that separation is an illusion is scattered all through Buddhist teachings. And what Padmasambhava taught is that because your nature is timeless awareness, that means your consciousness is independent of time. So your consciousness is independent of cause and effect. So cause and effect does not limit what you're able to do because your awareness is free of time. When I read that, I thought that was absolutely astonishing to have somebody writing about freedom of cause and effect 1,200 years ago. It looks like a theoretical physics text. And I'm not telling you this to sell you Buddhism. I'm just saying that what we're doing is not New Age. This was understood at a deep level many, many hundreds of years ago.
So it is, in fact, a kind of rediscovery in the modern era.
Yeah, it's rediscovering once upon a, again and again and again. The Taoists knew this at the time time of Buddha, the time of Confucius, the yin-yang symbol that we all know, the symbol that there's no separation. So this was, they were describing this 2,500 years ago. Lao Tse, Confucius, and Buddha all lived at the same time, 500 years before Christ. So you had a kind of psychic nexus going on with people realizing and writing about the fact that there's no limits to consciousness. So here we are 2,500 years later. We're looking at bomb tests, looking at Jupiter. One of the remarkable things that Pat Price was asked to do was for the CIA, look what was going on at a particular geographical coordinate. Uh-huh. And Price and I would go into our little shielded room. We're in a shielded room because initially we worked with Uri Geller, Israeli psychic, and we were worried that his mentor, Andrea Puharich, was interested in microelectronics, we knew, and micro hearing aids. We were worried that Andrea would send messages to Uri. This is the radio in the tooth hypothesis. Yes. So we were working in a very excellent sound shielded room. And people, turns out the psychics like to work in the shielded room. And I had a slip of paper from Ken Kress, who was our CIA contract monitor. And Price said, well, this is an interesting place. I'm lying on a building and the sun feels good. And the giant crane rolling back and forth over my body, huge crane, the eight-wheel crane, four wheels on either side of the building. I'm going to have to draw that. And he drew that giant eight-wheel gantry crane. He wrote that it was a gantry crane. And the next day we took that to Ken Kress and his partner, and they unrolled a big top-secret photograph of the Soviet weapons factory called Semipalatinsk in Siberia. And indeed, they had a crane very greatly resembling what Price drew, eight-wheel gantry crane rolling over a building. And they said, well, that's very interesting. What are they doing in the building? Asked my contract monitor. So Price and I went back into our shielded room, and Price said, well, they're building some kind of giant sphere, and what they're doing is assembling it out of gore, sort of orange peel slices, and they're welding those slices together, trying to make a 60-foot diameter sphere out of these steel gores, and they're having a hard time doing it because the gores are so thick. And we brought that back to Ken Kress the next day, and he said, well, that's very interesting. Of course, we don't know what's in there, but it looks like some kind of particle confinement weapon for a weapon system. And it was 2 years later, after the death of Pat Price, that was revealed to us in the Aviation Week. They showed a picture of a giant steel sphere held out of gores in that site of Semipalatinsk.
Wow.
So
he had seen it 2 years earlier.
Excuse me?
He had seen it years before.
Right. So he was able to, well, that's a, we believe that he saw it clairvoyantly at the time. We know that he did not look at it. See, with psychic experiments, you're always worried that the person will describe the feedback that you show them.
Right.
So if I tell you I've got a picture in the envelope, and you say, it looks to me like a picture of a black pussycat. And I say, well, that's terrific. And then I open it up, and there's a picture of black pussycat. We don't know whether you are describing my cat that's in the corner or whether you're describing the picture in the envelope.
Right. So you have to clear away all of those distractions in order to get to the actual material.
That's right. The case of the spheres at Semipalatinsk make us all very happy, because we know for a fact that he didn't look at this feedback, because he died 6 months after he did that remote viewing. The CIA was worried about such a psychic guy hanging out with an enthusiast like me at SRI. So they took him from California and sequestered him in a farmhouse in West Virginia. And Price would then work every day at the CIA with Ken Kress doing operational things. And of course, Kress did not have any clearance. In fact, he was an active Scientologist, was sort of an anti-clearance. But in spite of his Scientology, he was such a remarkable person. Indeed, he was the only person we had ever worked with who was able to read things. As he was once asked to read, he was once asked to describe what's at coordinates, and the coordinates were a NSA listening post at Sugar Grove in Virginia. And Price was able to penetrate that site, draw a picture of the outside, and say in the basement there are a bunch of filing cabinets. And the interesting thing that they're doing there, I have a file folder in front of me, and they've got Flytrap and Minerva and 8-Ball and Q-Ball and Rackup, all these strange words. And those were code words for contemporaneous operational code word projects. Nothing could be more secret at that time. So the NSA was very upset about this, and they were upset with us, and they were upset with the CIA. So the next week we had a visit from the NSA and the CIA both of whom were very angry, wanting to know why Price was describing and releasing these code word top secret names. And he said, well, the more you hide something, the more it shines like a beacon in psychic space. Uh-huh. If you give me those coordinates, I'm then going to find the most psychic thing that resides at those coordinates.
Fascinating.
But the problem is that the NSA was angry with their friends at the CIA for targeting a psychic at these top secret at this top secret facility.
You mentioned on a number of occasions that you felt like Pat Price was possibly the most psychic individual that you had run across in your work. Pat Price had a mysterious death, and there have always been suspicions that his work with the CIA led to it. What do you want to say about that?
Well, Price was 57 years old. And now I'm 86, so that makes me feel like Price a pretty young man.
Mm-hmm.
So he was not sick, so he could have, but he did have a heart condition, as we say, like lots of people have heart conditions, and it's irrelevant. But he did die mysteriously. He left his home in Virginia, and he was on his way to see us. Now, mysteriously, just as he left Virginia, he bought $1 million term insurance in behalf of his wife. So if he was killed, she would get this $1 million, which in fact she received. That definitely occurred. Mm-hmm. He got as far as Las Vegas, and he was with friends, and he had seizures, and he died mysteriously. And no autopsy was done. We know that Kit Green came and saw his body in the hospital. And Kit Green said there was an autopsy, so there's nothing to look at. But we know for a fact that he was not cremated, because Hal Puthoff and I saw his body at a memorial for him at the Scientology Center. But the CIA had a problem. That is, they had this very psychic guy who could read anything in the world, who was also a Scientologist. And we now know that every day Price would meet with his Scientology auditor, or on the phone or by mail, and tell that auditor what they had done. So the reason we know that is that 2 years later, the IRS broke into the Scientology Celebrity Center and found a file folder of documents from Pat Price describing the top secret things that he was doing with Ken Criss. Wow. So we know absolutely that every day that he was doing these top secret spying things for the CIA, he was handing that in to the Scientology. Now, my opinion, see, I don't know the answer to this question. I don't know how Pat Price died, but I know that the Scientologists would not have been amused to find out that their psychic Superman was a double agent. Well, what do you do then if the most psychic man in the world is also handing all this stuff over to the Scientologists?
So you're saying the CIA had a problem. They didn't like the idea that that their top guy was handing over information to the Scientologists.
That's exactly right. See, Pat Price was not a... Price was a smart man, but he wasn't trained in spycraft. He wasn't a spy. Now, he was just sitting out there in his farmhouse in West Virginia and picked up each day by the CIA and brought to headquarters. Now, I can't believe that he wasn't under surveillance at that time. Because he was an uncleared guy, actively involved in contemporaneous psychic spying on all sorts of foreign embassies. I can't believe that he was unsurveilled by the CIA. It wouldn't make any sense.
So they knew he was seeing this Scientologist.
My conjecture. Because we now know that as the... A year after Price died, the IRS broke into the CIA and all these documents came forward. So there's no doubt that Price was turning in his documents to the Scientologists. These very accurate drawings of embassies and structures all over the world. There's no doubt that Price was turning them into the Scientology. Now, that would be, if the CIA knew that, that would be a big problem for them. So Price definitely died mysteriously. He was on his way to see us and to see his son in Salt Lake, and he died. Now, he might have had a heart attack. The Russians might have killed him because the Russians knew that this was going on, we now know. Or the CIA may have killed him because they didn't know what to do with this guy who was handing over this top secret material. So it's a mystery. I don't know the answer.
I can appreciate it. Wasn't there an unusual comment regarding Pat Price that came from a high CIA official named Stansfield Turner?
Oh, Stansfield Turner was the head of the CIA.
Yes.
And he was interviewed by the Chicago Tribune. So, yeah, we once had a guy working for us who could see inside buildings and describe what was going on anywhere in the world, but he died and we haven't heard from him since.
Yeah.
Which I thought was an odd thing for, it sort of verified that Price was really doing what we thought he was doing. And it indicates that people really have the ability to quiet their mind and look anywhere in the world.
Yes. And can you just tell me how Price came into the SRI program to start with? Because he sounds like he was remarkable. All the remote viewers are, but he sounds particularly unusual.
Now, I'll answer your question. I should say, at the time, Price was the most psychic person we had ever seen. Although Ingo Swann was also very psychic, and we could just sit in his office and flip out to Jupiter, 500 miles away. So Swann was also very talented, but yeah. He was sort of the guru and didn't feel like being tested so much.
Uh-huh.
Somebody would raise a question, what's going on there? He might tell you if he felt like it. But he taught us about separating the psychic signal from the mental noise and avoiding targets where you had too much information. For example, guessing playing cards is a very, very hard thing to do because you know what they all look like. So if I tell you that I've got a card in my hand, you immediately see diamonds, hearts, spades, and clubs, from your memory, and that's mental noise. Uh-huh. It's much easier for me to say that I've just pulled down a book from my library and opened it to a picture. Tell me about that picture. You have no idea what it is. That's a much easier task than guessing a number from 1 to 10. Because with the book containing the mystery picture, you have no information. The number from 1 to 10, you really have insuperable mental images, mental noise. So the whole trick in remote viewing, I've taught remote viewing now for 40 years, and what you have to help people do is to separate the psychic signal from the mental noise.
I see.
So that one of my opening numbers on stage is a experiment that's not double blind, but I will have some interesting thing that I brought from home or the curio shop. See, I've got an interesting object here in my briefcase. quiet your mind and tell me about the surprising image that shows up in your awareness. And I say, you can't do that wrong, because only you know what's in your awareness.
Right.
And that is generally successful. That is, that's an experiment there. I just did that yesterday with my 6-year-old granddaughter, and she drew a wonderful picture, wonderful rendition of a picture that I had wrapped up in bandanas, and she had never heard of remote viewing. She was having porridge with my wife. And I said, I have something for you to do. And she just drew a terrific drawing of a smiling cat, which is exactly what I had on the book cover.
Wow.
Yes. So that's what I've been doing. That's basically what I've been doing for 40 years, that particular magic trick.
That's incredible.
What is that, although Price was a uniquely capable person, the only one who could read things, Ingo Swann was a great psychic. We brought in a woman who's a friend of mine, Hella Hammett, a very talented, known photographer, and she had never done this before. And we brought her in as a control, and I taught her how to do remote viewing, or asked her to do remote viewing, or showed her the moves. And in formal trials, she did even better than Pat Price. Amazing. Pat Price did a formal series. Our first formal series was significant at odds of 1 in 100,000, and we published that in Nature magazine. We then did a similar series with Hella, and her work was significant at 1 in 1,000,000. And then we published Hella and Pat Price in the Proceedings of the Electrical Engineering Society. But the important thing is that Hella was our control subject, and the control subject did 10 times better than the most psychic person we ever saw.
Remarkable. So you don't know, in a sense, where you're going to find this incredible psychic talent.
Well, we think it's more available than you might expect. So after Hella and Pat, the CIA, really the Army, said, we're tired of coming to California to find hidden stuff. It's embarrassing. Couldn't you train up create an Army Psychic Corps? And they gave us 30 people to look at, and I chose 10, I chose 6. And one of those was Joe McMonagall. And I chose them by interviewing them about their experiences and their feeling about ESP. And McMonagall had psychic experiences in Vietnam. And Joe turned out to be a very prodigious psychic. Of the 6, he was very much the best, although others were pretty good. And Joe is now continuing. So we did the experiments with Joe starting 1978. So we're now 30 years later, and Joe is still doing very, very successful remote viewing. The important thing about that is that there is no decline effect. The thing that was the big problem for J.B. Ryan at Duke University is that people could do card guessing, and then they got bored into a decline. So they did really well in the beginning, and then they did worse and worse, and then fell away to chance. In our remote viewing work, there is no decline. No, in all of In my decade at SRI, I did hundreds of remote viewing trials with many people, and there's no evidence of a decline. Hella didn't decline. Jack Paul, Joe McMonagall is still doing outstanding remote viewing, finding children, finding where the gold mine is, finding water, doing stuff for the Army. So 40 years later, Joe is still doing excellently. So although the decline effect was a big problem for ESP studies in the 40s and 50s, it was not a problem at SRI.
Remarkable. When you look back, and you've worked with some of the best psychics and remote viewers and created this incredible program, is there an occasion when you go back there in time and you see one case of a remote viewing session that just made your jaw drop and said, I can't believe this? I mean, there's very interesting examples, but what was that one that just made you feel like, wow?
Well, toward the end of my, see, I left SRI, I started the program in 72. Mm-hmm. By 82, it was so successful that the whole program was top secret and I couldn't publish anything anymore.
Ah.
The feeling was I did not go to graduate school to be a psychic spy for the CIA. My father was a distinguished New York publisher, so I grew up and were, if you're a real person, you publish stuff.
Right.
I've written several books, and I've written several more now. But the CIA said you can't publish anything at all. So I was getting ready to leave the program. And our contract monitor, Ken Kress, said, well, we'd like you to do one last thing working with Hella here. Could you describe what Premier Brezhnev's office looks like in the Kremlin? And that would be atypical. He said, you don't know what Brezhnev, you've never been to the Kremlin, have you? And we laughed. And then, no, it's the furthest place we've ever not been to. So I sat down with Hella and said, well, we're going to the Kremlin today. We want us to look at Brezhnev's office. That was it. That was the target. And she said, well, I'm walking down a hallway. It's all carpeted in red. And at the end of the hallway is a door covered with red leather held in with upholstery tacks. And I said, well, can you describe what's going on inside that? And she said, no, the door is closed. So I said, well, I'll open the door for you. So I psychically pushed open the door. And she said, yes, I can see the door is open, but it's dark. They're 10 hours ahead of us, so it's dark at night. But I said, okay, I'll turn on the lights. This is like a joint lucid dream. So she said, all right, the lights are on now. I can see the very large wooden desk covered with glass on the right. And on the left, there's a window looking out over Red Square. I can see St. Basil's Church in Red Square. So the red square is on the left, the huge desk is on the right, and then the door and the wall behind the desk. And I said, well, why don't we see where that leads? I'll open the door. And she said, oh, the steps going down. So we could walk down the steps. And she said, well, I see, Hella said, I see big computer bays off to the right side, walls full of computers. And I began to feel frightened.
Oh, yeah.
I began to feel that I was exposed. And I said, you know, I think that's, I don't feel safe here. And I think we've told them enough. Let's get the hell out of here and end the experiment.
Yes.
So
wow, that's incredible. That sounds nerve-wracking too.
So 2 years later, I left the program. I was invited to lecture to the Soviet Academy of Science in the Kremlin. So I had a room full of people, and I explained to them about our work, show the pictures. And my daughter was with me, who's a fluent Russian speaker, so she could just sort of pull me off the stage and say, why don't I give this talk, Dad? We don't have to deal with their translator. So my daughter, Elizabeth, gave my talk, blowing people away. Where did this very young American fluent Russian speaker come from? And at the end, I say, well, what we're describing here is the fact that your consciousness can go anywhere. There are no secrets anymore. And that generated a lot of teacup shaking. And in Soviet Union, every lecture, everybody has a teacup that you're given when you sit down, a cup of tea. So it's telling them that your consciousness can go anywhere and there are no secrets anymore. In the Kremlin, this was shocking information. So we discussed that, and they said, well, is there anything you'd like to see in the Kremlin? I thought that was an odd question, like, what do they have in mind? And I said, yes, I'd like to see Premier Brezhnev's office. I don't have to see the prime minister, but I'd like to see where he sits. So they took me down this hall covered with red carpeting. At the end, there's a door covered with red leather. They open it up, and there's the desk on the right, the window on the left. I don't remember whether there's another door behind the desk, but everything that the red leather door with the upholstery tacks and the layout of the office was just as she had described to me 2 years before.
Incredible.
It's unbelievable.
So off to the side, my job as an interviewer, that I'm not a psychic practitioner, though I was called upon to do that once when Price was away. In general, my job is to sit with somebody and show them the moves.
Right.
Keep them from guessing, describing their mental images. So that's what I did with Hella. That was kind of a joint, continuum from remote viewing to out-of-body experiences. And Hella and I had sort of a joint experience where we together went to the Kremlin and described what was there.
Remarkable.
Russ, just incredible information. What a fantastic journey of showing us in a scientific way just how deep our psychic access can be. Now in part two, we're going to go even deeper and take a journey inside that limitless mind remote viewing experience. I highly recommend your classic book, The Reality of ESP. For 5 decades now, you've proven that reality. I want to remind everyone to visit you at espresearch.com and learn more about these amazing tools that you've developed. Now stay right there and we'll get deep into part two. And everyone remember to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for our newsletter to make sure you get all the episodes right in your inbox. Part two is coming up and you can find us on Fridays at 8 p.m. Eastern for the Dark Journalist X series. See you soon.